Good evening. Thank you all for coming. Mindolna, dear colleagues, dear students and guests. As some of you may recall, in the past it happened that I scheduled my lectures several times in the fall and they got moved to Lent. So this year I decided to go directly for Lent. And surprise, the lecture wasn't changed. So I took it as a sure sign that God wanted me to be part of your Lenten journey. In August 1894, just a few weeks after her father, Saint Louis, had died, Saint Therese wrote a poem, the first just for herself, entitled The Prayer of the Child of a Saint. This is how the first stanza finishes. I will read it first in French and then in English. Tu retrouves là-haut notre mère chérie, qui t'avait précédée dans la sainte patrie. Maintenant dans les cieux, vous régnez tous les deux. Veillez sur nous. You find up there our dear mother, who had preceded you in the Holy Fatherland. Now in the heavens, you reign together. Keep watch over us. It is clear that for Thérèse, her parents were already enjoying the beatific vision right after their death. If this poem was not enough, let us listen to her words to her sister Léonie from the same period. I am thinking of you more than ever after our dear father ascended into heaven. I really think that you have the same impressions as we. The death of Papa does not give me the impression of a death, but of a true life. It is not the first time that, with her extraordinary spiritual sense, Thérèse anticipated someone's canonization. A strong devotion to Joan of Arc, who was only beatified in 1909 and canonized in 1920, is shown in the two poems and two plays that she dedicated to the Maid of Orléans. But were Louis and Zélie Martin canonized because they were well-connected, having in the family a doctor of the church, the greatest saint of modern times, that Saint Pope Pius X called her? Let us try to get to know these new saints, the first to be canonized as a couple, before we give an answer. Before the marriage. In April 1858, a man is crossing the Saint-Léonard Bridge over the River Sarthe in Alençon. He's Louis Martin, age 35, a clockmaker and jeweler. He appears to be a serious, distinguished man who is not afraid of praying his beads in public. He wanted to join the monastery of the Grand Saint-Bernard in the Alps, but he did not know Latin. To remedy this lack, he took 120 lessons with a distinguished Latinist, but in vain. Latin and Louis Martin could not become good friends. What a pity the idea did not exist at the time. Having abandoned the idea of religious life, he continues being a faithful Catholic, who, for example, in order to obey the precepts of the Church, would not open his shop on Sundays, despite the profit he could make. Keeping the day of the Lord holy will be a precept always respected in his household, as we shall see, one that would be responsible for his financial success. He's living with his parents and his nephew, whom, an orphan, he is bringing up. Louis' father, a former captain of Napoleon, taught his son to give God always the first place. May God be always glorified and loved above all things, he wrote once to his son, while his mother encouraged him to be always humble. His parents had the misfortune of losing four of their children, a tragedy that Louis himself will also live. Even if he bought a little property with a garden and a tower close to the river, the pavilion, where he likes to withdraw in order to read, meditate, and fish, Louis is not a hermit. He's a member of the Catholic circle founded by his friend Vital Romet, where he not only joins his peers to reflect, pray, and socialize, but he also plays billiards, his favorite game. Louis is still single at 34, and his mother is worried. She mentioned to her son a few times the charming young lacemaker that she had met, Miss Guérin, but Louis seemed uninterested. Until that April day in 1858, when who else but the young lady just mentioned should be coming from the opposite direction on the bridge. Azélie Guérin is an elegant young lady, aged 26, who owns a lace-making shop that she had started with her elder sister. Azélie, whom everybody called Zélie, is producing a lace of queens and queen of laces, as the renown had it, which gave the town of Alençon its reputation. One needs 25 hours to produce a piece of lace the size of a stamp, a skill that takes 8 years to learn. Zélie's head of the shop, besides overseeing the whole work of 10 lace makers, she's the one to put together the small pieces that the workers are producing, the most difficult job, as it has to be done seamlessly. Zélie's business partner, her elder sister, had just become a visitation nun in Mons, an ideal that was Zélie's as well. Mother Superior of the Sisters of Saint-Vincent-de-Paul, however, dissuaded the candidate, on account of this one's weak constitution. As in the case of Louis Martin, not the most spiritual of reasons to help discern religious life. But God's ways and humor are not ours. Zélie, herself the daughter of a soldier that had fought in the Napoleonic Wars, had a difficult childhood with a severe and authoritarian mother who left her daughter famished for affection and would not even buy her one little doll. Seeing that religious life was not to be hers, Zélie prayed like this. My God, since I am not worthy to become your spouse like my sister, I shall enter the married state to accomplish your holy will. I beg you then, let me have many children, and may they all be consecrated to you, my God. The young lacemaker had started her business under a special inspiration received on December the 8th, 1851, in answer to her question about how to provide for herself. As she was walking that April day across the bridge and was greeted by Louis Martin, she heard another interior voice telling her, "This is the one that I have prepared for you." And so it was. 3 months later, Louis and Zélie were married at midnight on the 12th, 13th of July in the church of Notre-Dame of Alençon. Louis made a marriage medal that he gave to his wife. It represented Tobias and Sarah, the couple that would place God first in their marriage. Married life. Like Tobias and Sarah, the Martins chose to live in perfect chastity, but not just for the wedding night, but for life. Not an easy choice for Zélie to make her own, but which she did, together with her husband, for 10 months of their married life. At that point, a wise confessor helped them both realize the beauty of having children. And with the same devotion that they offered up their fruitfulness, they would also launch in the adventure of having children. 9 of them, 7 girls and 2 boys. As a special note, all Martin children, boys included, would have as their first name Marie, while the boys would be called Joseph. Little wonder in a family that followed the Holy Family as a model. At a time when not even the phone was in public use, people would cover distance by letters. In the Martin family, Zélie is the assiduous letter writer, and 218 of these epistles survived, while we have only 16 of Louise. These letters, together with the testimonies of the Martin girls, are the main source for knowing Louis and Zélie Martin. In her first letter directed to her brother Isidore, Zélie describes her family life. When I think of what the good Lord, in whom I placed all my trust and in whose hands I placed the care of my affairs, has done for me and my husband, I cannot doubt that his divine providence keeps watch with particular care over his children. This note of trust in divine providence will be present throughout the entire correspondence, in happy and especially in difficult moments. After encouraging her brother, then a pharmacy student in Paris, to pray to Our Lady as Louis Martin did, she concludes, "I continue to be happy, to be very happy with him. He makes my life very sweet. My husband is a holy man. I wish one like him to all women. This is my wish for them for the new year." Louis addresses his first letter that we have to his beloved friend, Zélie, "Cher ami," and he signs, "Ton mari est vrai ami qui t'aime pour la vie," your husband and true friend who loves you forever. What a sweet and precious thing to discover that the two spouses who had only known each other a few months before they got married had become best friends. In his first letter after the death of his wife, he returns his wife's compliment, and takes leave of his girl thus, "Adieu, my dear children. I press you all on my heart as I love you and entrust you to your holy mother." To be sure, the Martins were not applying the epithets of sanctity to each other in a canonical sense, but it shows that each other was aware of breathing each other's odor of sanctity. Ordinary means. What ordinary means would the Martins employ daily to nourish their faith? To begin with, Holy Mass at 5:30 a.m., a practice that became so known to their neighbors that whenever they heard the door close at that ungodly hour, they would just turn over for more sleep, knowing it was the Holy Martin couple. Sometimes even a second or third Holy Mass, as this letter of Zélie to her husband testifies. "I cannot wait to be with you, my dear Louis. I love you with all my heart, and I feel my affection grow yet double by the privation of your presence that I feel. It would be impossible for me to live separated from you. This morning I attended 3 masses. I went to the one of 6, made my act of thanksgiving during the one at 7, and returned to the high mass." The Martins would pray the rosary daily, go to confession regularly, pray novenas for special intentions, go on pilgrimages, fast, following much more severe precepts than we do today. Zélie writes her brother the following about the visit of their aunt. "Next week, Wednesday, Friday, and Saturday are Ember days. You know that Louis is a strict observer of the commandments of the Church. He would not wish at any cost to eat meat, or not to fast on those days, and I doubt very much if our aunt would care to follow the law. When M.D. came during Lent, you would not believe how embarrassed we felt. Louis was the only one fasting, since M.D. dispensed for the time being. He had to watch us eating nice things while he was taking just his light collation, and we had to keep the abstinence." Louis was also a devout participant in nocturnal adoration. Once he even detected and managed to put out the fire that had broken during adoration. Needless to say, Louis nourished his faith with spiritual readings, which he sometimes shared with his children, like a certain book by Abbé Armand Jean, which was very profitable to Thérèse. As I mentioned before, keeping the day of the Lord holy was a precept that Louis observed dutifully, both before his marriage and after. They would buy nothing on Sunday, and Zélie, in a letter to her sister-in-law, attributes her husband's success to this faithfulness. She says, "Very often I admire the strictness of Louis, and I say to myself, there's a man who never tried to amass a fortune. When he was studying in business, his confessor suggested to him, so he told me, to open his jewelry store on Sundays until noon. But Louis never wanted to use that permission, preferring rather to lose business. In spite of that, he has become rich. I can attribute his comfortable financial position to no other cause than a special blessing of God, a result of his faithful observance of Sunday. Louis had a special passage from Holy Scripture that he often meditated and shared with his girls. Ego sum mercis tua magna nimis. I am thy exceeding great reward, from the book of Genesis, chapter 15. It was this line that was deemed fitting by his girls for the mortuary card. The card represented the suffering face of our Lord. According to Céline, one of the Matin girls, her father's outstanding virtue was his charity towards his neighbor. Louis saw his Lord in his suffering brethren and sought to alleviate his sufferings. Thus, he would often run to the rescue whenever he heard an alarm bell. As the very good swimmer that he was, he saved a number of people from drowning, even if at the peril of his life. More than once, he saved people from fires. The son of an army captain that he was could not show less bravery. But Louis naturally was even more concerned for the spiritually endangered. Thus, not only would he and his family pray for the ones that needed his prayers, but he would go out of his way to make sure that the dying had access to the sacraments. He would particularly have holy masses celebrated for the faithful departed, a work of mercy that he shared with his wife. Punctual lessons. Of the many things one could learn from the Martins, here are a few examples gleaned mainly from the letters. How to choose a good wife. Zélie, her youngest brother's senior by 10 years, was very concerned for his spiritual welfare and would not hesitate to tell him how to choose a good wife. In doing so, she is in fact describing herself. You know that gold is not all that glitters. The important thing is to find a good interior woman who is not afraid to dirty her hands working and who only loves her dress as she should, who knows how to bring up her children in work and piety. How to love one's spouse. Love craves to be expressed not just in acts, but also in words. This is what Zélie writes her husband in the 11th year of marriage. I kiss you with all my heart. I am so happy today at the thought of welcoming you back again that I cannot work for the joy of it. Your wife who loves you more than her life. How to educate children. Zélie explicitly taught her children to aim for sanctity. You must serve the good God faithfully, my dear girls, and beg to be one day in the number of those saints whose feasts we celebrate today. This is how Céline describes her mother's education methods. She accustomed us to obey through love, to please the dear Jesus, to make small sacrifices for him. Zélie herself gives her brother this advice about difficult children. Do not be uneasy if you find your little Jeanne manifesting a temper. That will not prevent her from growing up to be an excellent child later on, and even to be your consolation. I remember how Pauline, up to the age of 2, was the same, and how distressed I was about her. And now she is my best. But I must tell you that I didn't spoil her, either. Little as she was, I let her get away with nothing, without, however, making a little martyr out of her. But she had to give in. One among 5 grown girls, Céline remembers how her mother dressed them. She was very exacting with regard to perfect modesty, and our dresses always reached below the knees. How to get through the day? Zélie always had her hands full, whether with children, running the household, or working at her lace. How did she manage it all? This is what she wrote to her sister-in-law. The good Lord fits the back for the burden and never asks more than we can bear. Very often I have seen my husband worried about my health, while I couldn't have been calmer. I used to say to him, "Don't be afraid. The good God is with us." I had, though, loads of work and preoccupations, but I felt that firm confidence of being always helped from heaven. Respect for the priesthood. The Martins had a profound respect for priests and wished, should the Lord desire it, to have a missionary priest stem from among their boys. We know that Therese desired, among other vocations, to be a priest. Céline provides more details about her father in this area. "His respect for priests was so great," she writes, "that I never saw anything like it. I remember when I was a little child, I imagined from what I had heard that priests were like gods. I was so accustomed to have them placed above the common level. I never heard him express a criticism of the clergy, not find fault with a sermon. He listened with a devout respect to the word of God, without considering the quality of the instrument which transmitted it." Sanctity does not mean perfection. One is often overwhelmed by the example of the saints and tends to say, "I cannot imitate them. I cannot be a saint." For those of us struggling during Lent, this confession of Zélie's will be encouraging. "We are in the full period of penance. Fortunately, it will be soon over, for I suffer so much from fasting and abstinence. It is not, however, such a hard mortification, but I feel my stomach so weak, and especially I feel so cowardly, that if I listened to myself, I would not want to do anything at all." Humor. St. Francis of Sales once said, "Un saint triste est un triste saint." A sad saint cuts a sad figure of a saint. While being serious about the only thing important in life, that of sanctifying one's life, the Martins had a good sense of humor. For example, in reference to the difficult sacrifice that Louis, then a widower, had to make in allowing Thérèse to enter the Carmel, a friend said to him, "Abraham had no lesson to teach you. Like him, if God had demanded it, you would have sacrificed to him your little queen." He replied instantly, "Yes, but I confess I would have raised my sword slowly, hoping to see the angel and the ram." Zélie's humor is seen mostly in regard to the children. Soon after the birth of Thérèse, her mother wrote to her brother. Even before the baby was born, Sister Marie d'Ossité, the sister of Zélie, imagining that it was going to be a boy, had written to me asking me not to give him the name of Joseph, but Francis, as if she suspected that good Saint Joseph had taken the others away from me. I replied to her that whether the new little boy would die or not, it was Joseph he would be called. Or in another letter, this time from 1868, shortly after the death of her father. "Many people think that I have not got long to live. I hope they're wrong, for I have no time to die. I have too much work for the moment." Illness and death of Zélie. In 1858, before her marriage, Zélie struck herself against the corner of a table. In 1865, she noticed a swelling in her breast, but no treatment was prescribed, and it was only in 1876 that there was an increasing pain and the cancer confirmed. She had much suffering in life. After a sad childhood and youth, she had to bury four of her children, her father and sister. And already in 1865, she didn't think she would have a long life. This is what she writes to her sister-in-law after she gave the bad news. "I would really wish that you would not be too distressed and that you would resign to the will of God. If he found me useful on earth, he would certainly not permit that I would have this sickness. For I asked him much, not to take me from this world as long as I would be necessary for my children. Whatever will be, let us profit from the good time that remains for us, and let us not torment ourselves. Besides, it will never be but what the good Lord will want. She uses the same strength and trust in divine providence to console her husband after a doctor's appointment that showed it was too late for surgery. Let us entrust ourselves into the hands of the good Lord. He knows better than us what is needed. For he wounds, but he also binds up. I will go to Lourdes on the first pilgrimage, and I hope that the Holy Virgin will heal me if it is necessary. In the meanwhile, let us calm ourselves. Her humility and humor at the end of the same month are impressive. I am like the children who are not worried of tomorrow. I always hope for happiness. As for me, I am trying to convert, but I cannot make it. It is really true that one dies as one lived. One cannot go against the current when one wants. I assure you, I am fully aware of it. Sometimes I get discouraged. It is said that only a moment is needed to turn a reprobate into a saint. But I think it is only a very little saint. Oh well, you've got to have all kinds. I wish you much happiness for this new year. If the good Lord grants my wishes, you will be as happy as Adam and Eve in the earthly paradise. They had better stayed there and not plunged us into misery as they did. I am not grateful to them for that. It takes heroic poverty to pray for one's life, but to do so with detachment. Zélie instructs her daughter Pauline as follows. We need to place ourselves in the disposition of accepting generously the will of God, whatever it may be. For it will always be whatever can be best for us. In June 1877, Zélie, together with her three eldest, Marie, Pauline, and Léonie, went on a pilgrimage to Lourdes to ask for her healing. The pilgrimage not only did not produce its desired effects, but made things worse, as if to confirm Zélie's great dislike for them. Among the added difficulties, she missed a step on the stairs and badly twisted her neck, a suffering that would produce her much pain later. Then Marie lost the rosary, the only object her mother had from her recently deceased sister, Sister Marie d'Ossité. Then plunging in the ice-cold water almost made Zélie faint. She even tore her dress badly. As our Lord told Saint Teresa of Avila, who was complaining of a trial, this is the treatment I give to my friends, to which, as you know, the funny saint answered, no wonder that you have so few. Did this fiasco dampen Zélie's spirits? Not in the least. When she met her husband, who was waiting for her at the train station, she was so cheerful that you would have thought that she had actually been healed. She writes to Pauline, I continue to have a very firm hope of healing, and it only keeps on increasing. I start my novenas again. I put Lourdes water on my wound every night, and after that I live in hope and in peace, waiting for the arrival of God's hour. Let one not be deceived and think that Zélie didn't have to fight to the end. She asks her sister-in-law for these gifts. Ask them for me, please, resignation and patience. I need them greatly. You know I have no patience. One night at the end of July, her suffering increased greatly. I suffered for 24 hours, she wrote her brother, more than I ever suffered in my whole life. Thus I spent these hours moaning and crying. I was imploring all the saints in heaven, one after the other, and no one answered. I had to moan all night. Louis, Marie, and the maid stayed up with me. This poor Louis, from time to time, would take me in his arms, like a child. Her last letter, written to her brother, ends like this. What do you expect? If the Holy Virgin does not heal me, it is that my time is up, and that the good Lord wants me to repose elsewhere as on earth. Zélie finished her earthly pilgrimage on the 28th of August, 1877. Her daughter Céline summed up her short life in these words: always active, devoted, constantly smiling. Our mother never appeared to be doing anything extraordinary, but with remarkable simplicity and humility, she tirelessly spent herself for others and lived always for the good God. Léonie. The third child of the Martins was the one that worried her mother most. Less endowed, both physically and intellectually, than her other siblings, Léonie felt somewhat like the ugly duckling of the lot. Add a purulent eczema that she had from an early age on, not the ingredients for a very happy life. In 1874, when Léonie was 11, she was sent back from the boathouse of the Visitandine. Her mother shows her disappointment, but also her hope, in these words: my only hope was in my sister to reform this child, and I was convinced they would keep her. But it is not possible. Despite the best goodwill, she had to be separated from the other children. As soon as she finds herself in company, she does not control herself anymore and shows a matchless dissipation. Well, only a miracle could change this nature. It is true, I do not deserve a miracle, and nevertheless, I hope against all hope. The more difficult I see her, the more I am convinced that the good Lord will not permit that she stay like this. I will pray so much that he will relent. She was healed at the age of 18 months of a disease from which she should have died. Why would the good God have saved her from death if he did not have plans of mercy for her? It is impressive to see the mother's genuine distress matched only by her complete trust that the good Lord was still at work in this difficult child. Léonie herself suffered a lot from her perceived inferiority. As a Visitandine, she once told her younger sister, Thérèse, that she felt good for nothing, to which Thérèse answered, "You are the bride of Jesus." Already at an early age, Léonie wanted to become a nun, but it took 3 rejections to be finally admitted to the monastery of the Visitation in Caen. She was a true disciple of the little way of her sister. Her strength was her humility and littleness, as she wrote. "Humility is my only saving board. I love it above all else." And elsewhere, "I'm so little and weak. I want to grow and remain little at the same time." In 1934, after 35 years of religious life, she gave more insight about God's work in her. "It is my extreme misery that gives me this confidence. The good Lord made me see as clear as the day that I always need to plunge evermore into my nothingness. He makes me love my littleness, my incapacity for any good." Zélie's hopes for her daughter would not be disappointed. On the 2nd of July 2015, the process of beatification of Sister Françoise Thérèse, the religious name of Louise, of Léonie, whose body was discovered incorrupt, was officially opened. Illness and death of Louis. After the death of his wife, Louis, following her wish, moved from Alençon to Lisieux to be close to Zélie's brother Isidore and his family. It is from there that, one by one, he would offer to God, with renewed poverty, his girls, Pauline in 1882, Marie in 1886 to join the Carmel in Lisieux. Léonie the same year, first to join the Poor Clares, then the Visitandines in Caen. Thérèse in 1888 for the Carmel in Lisieux, to be joined there later by Céline in 1894. When Thérèse, her father's queen, as he affectionately used to call her, revealed to him her desire to join her elder sisters for the Carmel, he agreed wholeheartedly. Thérèse describes this last supreme offering of her father's like this. Papa seemed to enjoy the quiet peace of the sacrifice performed. He spoke to me as a saint. I would wish to recall his words and write them here, but I have only a memory that remains too fragrant to be analyzed in human words. While waiting for the permission for Thérèse to enter the Carmel, Louis took her and Céline on a pilgrimage to Rome, where they even got an interview with the Holy Father, Pope Leo XIII. Thérèse, while not obtaining from him the permission that was denied her in Lisieux, recalls this special incident. As a special sign of benevolence, the sovereign pontiff had placed his hand on Papa's head, thus appearing to mark him with a mysterious seal in the name of Christ himself, whose representative he truly is. A year after she joined her Carmelite sisters, Thérèse helps us understand better something of the mysterious plan God had with Louis. Before my entrance to Carmel, our incomparable father said in giving me to God, I would wish to have something still better to offer to the good God. Jesus has listened to this prayer, to his prayer. The something better is himself. Céline, who was with her father all the way to his death, gives the last stages of Louis' battle. In 1876, he was stung by a poisonous fly behind his ear, seemingly a minor infection, but which developed and caused him much pain and would only disappear in the last months of his life. On the 1st of May, 1887, he had a paralysis attack that immobilized his left side completely. The strong, healthy, industrious head of a family was reduced to speaking inarticulately and to dragging his leg. He confided to his daughters, "My poor children, we are as fragile as the blossoms on the trees in springtime. In the evening, we, like them, seem wonderful. The following morning, an hour's frost withers and shrivels us up." Louis was better for a short while, during which Thérèse's clothing could take place on January the 10th, 1889. The bride describes the ceremony herself. "The feast was enchanting. The most beautiful and enchanting flower of all was my darling king. Never was he more beautiful or more noble. He was the admiration of all. That day was his triumph, his last feast here below." Then she continues, "January the 10th was Papa's day of triumph. I likened it to the feast of Christ's entrance into Jerusalem on Palm Sunday, for his day of glory was followed by a dolorous passion, just as in the case of our Divine Master, whose passion was not for himself alone. As the agony of Jesus pierced the heart of his Holy Mother, so were our hearts deeply wounded by the humiliations and sufferings of him whom we loved best on earth." On the 12th of February, 1889, barely a month after Thérèse's clothing, Louis, then aged 66, suffered from cerebral arteriosclerosis and was committed to a mental health establishment called Le Bon Sauveur, the Good Savior, in Caen. Léonie and Céline moved to Caen to be close to their father. In his clear moments, he would often tell them, "I am very well here, and I am here because it is the will of God. I needed this trial. Besides, I can do good around here. How many need conversion?" He does not hide that he would have preferred to be an apostle elsewhere, but he accepts it as coming from the hand of God. He later reflected, I was always accustomed to command, and here I must obey. It is hard. But I know why God has sent me this trial. I never had any humiliation in my life. I needed one. Louis, deepening, emptying of himself, following in the footsteps of Christ, led him to reply to Celine, who informed him that all were making a novena to Saint Joseph for his cure and return to Lisieux. He said, "No, you must not ask that, but only the will of God." Thérèse's profession on the 24th of September 1890 was approaching, and she dearly wished her father to be present and to bless her there, but it was impossible. She wrote to Céline the eve of the event, "Jesus wishes me to be an orphan. He desires me to be alone with him alone, in order to be more intimately united with himself." In May 1892, Louis was finally returned to his family. He was taken to see his Carmelite daughters, his last visit. When, at the moment of his leaving, Céline writes, the Carmelites were saying goodbye to him, he raised his eyes, pointed with his finger to heaven, and remained thus for quite a while, being unable to express his thoughts except by these words, uttered in a voice full of tears, "In heaven." In June, during the Corpus Christi procession, Louis was privileged to have the monstrance placed on his head, an exterior sign of the interior union between him and his master. On July the 28th, Louis had another heart attack. Céline was alone with him. "I was praying with all my heart, begging God to inspire me as to what I ought to do, for I had never assisted a dying person. Then I said out loud these three invocations: Jesus, Mary, Joseph, I give you my heart, my soul, and my life. Jesus, Mary, and Joseph, assist me in my last agony. Jesus, Mary, and Joseph, may I breathe forth my soul in peace with you." At that moment, my beloved father opened his eyes, fixed them on me with affection and ineffable gratitude. His eyes were filled with life and understanding. And then he closed them forever. The last stanza of the poem I quoted at the beginning, "The Prayer of the Child of a Saint," ends like this. Again, I will read the French and then the English. "Maintenant, tes enfants t'adressent leurs prières. Ils bénissent ta croix et ta douleur amère. Sur ton front glorieux rayonne dans les cieux neuf lys en fleurs. Now your children direct to you their prayer. They bless your cross and bitter pain. On your glorious brow shine in the heavens nine lilies blooming." Thérèse addressed this poem to her father, but this last stanza could equally apply to her mother. What could one do with an example such as theirs? Little Thérèse is our guide yet again in a letter to Louis. If she, Thérèse, is not a saint, it will really be her fault. For with a father like you, she really has the means for it. With the canonization of Louis and Zélie Martin, the Church gives them as examples of Christian parents who work their sanctification day by day in the family. If Thérèse became a saint, a great one, it was because she was inflamed to follow their example in her little way. We have at our disposal all the ordinary means that they had. What about us? Thank you.